Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the last half hour of the program on this Thursday afternoon, the 23rd of July, Terry Mattingly joins us to talk about several issues. The long-fought battles in the Episcopal Church USA over the issue of homosexuality. You think it started lately? Not really. It has quite a history, quite a pedigree. Also in the United Methodist Church, they seem to be talking and arguing about sex incessantly and have been for decades. We'll talk about that with Terry. There's an ecumenical dialogue between the Orthodox Church in America and the newly formed Anglican Church in North America. We'll also talk a little bit about the phenomenon that are megachurches. Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion. He founded getreligion.org. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
This thing in the Episcopal Church USA that we read about just late last week, early this week, over homosexuality, did it start with Gene Robinson, the one who is kind of the poster child for the gay agenda in the Episcopal Church?
Well, if you read the mainstream media's kind of summations of this, you would think that is when it started. I've tried to remind the press repeatedly at Get Religion, and I finally got so kind of ticked off I wrote a column about it. I mean, this, at the very least, and if you only want to say this is about homosexuality, I mean, actually there are a lot of other extremely significant issues that are at stake, both doctrinally and everything else, but of course it's sexuality that grabs the headlines. But even if you wanted to say it was just homosexuality, that fight itself dates into the late 70s. I mean, when you really, I think that was where I first saw something very significant. The Episcopal Church passed what was essentially a pretty traditional statement on sexuality and homosexuality, but it was at that meeting that you had a very influential circle of 21 bishops publish, in effect, the minority statement. And one of the key voices in that minority statement was the man who only a few years after that was then elected as the leader of the entire Episcopal Church. So it was very apparent at that time in the late 60s that this revolt already, the revolt which is now the norm, very much had legs. And then you head into all kinds of things. You have you had the first, you know, ordination of an openly homosexual priest. That's, you know, that's coming along up in the Diocese of New York, you know, it quite quickly. Let's see, when was that? Oh, that's in the 70s. So then you get more ordinations in the mid-80s, and then you had a heresy trial in the mid-80s when an official court of the church ruled that the church actually had no doctrine whatsoever on this subject. That's the mid-80s. You move on into the, you know, into the 90s, I'm sorry, that the ecclesiastical court thing was in the mid-90s. It started in the 80s. Then you hit the big statement by the Lambeth, the Global Conference speaks out in 98. You want me to keep going on and on with this thing? I mean, you already had the ordination of illegal conservative bishops as missionaries to North America happens like 3 years before Gene Robinson, you know, is elected, so if is consecrated. So if this thing is just starting with Gene Robinson, why in the world is the Third World already consecrating illegal conservative bishops to serve America 3 years earlier? See what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
It just goes back and back. But if you frame it with Gene Robinson, you don't have to look at all the other issues, all the other cases, the doctrinal issues involved in all of this, and you just get to say in your newspaper article, this is a fight about prejudice against a gay bishop.
How telling is it? You mentioned in your article John Shelby Spong, who has been a one-time guest on this program. He was at the forefront, at least in kind of the open ordinations of gay priests, and
yeah.
Then, of course, calling for what he called a liberal reformation. How telling is it that Spong, even in those days, along with spearheading some of these movements toward a laxity on sexual issues, was also denying cardinal doctrines of the historic faith openly?
Well, you could tick off pretty much everything in the Nicene Creed, and he denied it at one time or another. The resurrection, the virgin birth, just for starters. I think what really raised a lot of eyebrows and even got him condemned on the personal level as just being way out of bounds by the man who's currently the rather left-of-center Archbishop of Canterbury. Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, said Spong wasn't making any sense. He denied, for example, the actual existence of a personal God, you know, and that prayer served any function other than psychological comfort. In effect, he denied theism in a book, in print, and by that point in the life of the Episcopal Church, nobody even bothered to bring heresy charges against him. I mean, because what's heresy?
All right. Moving from the Episcopal Church USA and the Worldwide Anglican Communion to the United Methodist Church, you've also written recently about what some are bemoaning in that once very large Protestant denomination, kind of an obsession with, if not sex, then arguing about sex. What do we know?
Well, this is an exact parallel. This is happening in almost all the mainline churches. What's really interesting about the Methodists is they have a mechanism that, in effect, that assigns the number of votes to their meetings, to their conferences, their general conferences or annual conferences, the big show. They assign the number of they divvy up the votes, so to speak, based on the statistical health of certain regions. Then you throw in the fact that the United Methodist Church actually includes in its voting mechanisms third world leaders. So you throw that in there, and the Methodists have a lot more kind of open space for the conservatives and their larger churches to have influence. Whereas, say, in the Episcopal Church, especially in the House of Bishops, you have all kinds of dioceses that, you know, are very small now when it comes of how many members there are or how many people are worshiping there on a Sunday morning, but they have large endowment funds, and they can still afford to have, you know, two or three bishops. And all of those bishops get to vote, you know, in the House of Bishops. The Methodists are fascinating because here the conservatives don't control any of the bureaucracy. They don't control any of the seminaries. The only seminary that they have is one that's recognized or accredited by the church but doesn't get a single dollar out of the offering plates, and that's the Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky. You have the liberals basically control so much of the mechanism, but yet the numbers of the conservatives continue to grow, and because of that, they're winning more battles at the level of their conferences. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like it's a unique feature of their political system, if you would.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is that if you're a United Methodist, let's say you're in the Presbyterian Church USA, and you decide to leave your Presbyterian Church USA congregation, in most of your cities and towns, you have other options that to one degree or another are clearly Presbyterian. You have Presbyterian Church in America, you have the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In some parts of the South, you have the old Cumberland Presbyterian. If you're a United Methodist, there really isn't another clearly Wesleyan church, even if you have some like the Nazarenes who draw on some similar historical roots. you have the Wesleyan Church, maybe, but that's a tiny church in comparison to the true zip code by zip code hegemony of the, you know, of the United Methodist Church. So Methodists are hanging in there, and that fight is still very much alive, whereas the Episcopal Church fight is now basically over.
With only a minute,
at the level of the mechanism of the national church.
With only a minute before we take a break, we'll continue on the other side of the break with Terry Mattingly. You mentioned the Wesleyan legacy. Would John Wesley recognize at least the mindset of the leadership in the United Methodist Church in America today?
He would in certain parts of the country, and that's the key thing. Two decades ago at least, there was a remarkable paper that came out by some writers, and it was either the six or the seven churches of United Methodism. The seven churches of Methodism. And this was a very prophetic document, and what it essentially said, that the faith preached from your pulpit and celebrated at your altars and taught in your Bible studies is completely different in the United Methodist Church, depending on where you live in the country. And I've seen nothing to indicate that that isn't just as true today as it was when that thing came out in the mid-1980s.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with him. We'll turn to the subject of the McChurch. And I think it's a good term. We'll find out what it means when we come back. It's Thursday afternoon, July the 23rd. Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service. He's author of the book, Pop Goes Religion. You can purchase Terry's book, Pop Goes Religion, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be right back.
So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
Come join us for a live broadcast of Issues Etc. from the National Lutherans for Life Conference. We'll be broadcasting live Friday afternoon, July the 24th, from the Doubletree Westport in St. Louis. Joining us will be Bobby Schindler, brother of Terry Schindler Schiavo. Issues Etc. live from the National Lutherans for Life Conference, Friday afternoon, July the 24th, at the Westport Doubletree in St. Louis. For more information, visit lutheransforlife.org.
Would you like to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a regular, monthly, tax-deductible gift? We've made it easy for you to donate using automatic withdrawal. Simply fill out and mail the automatic billing authorization form under the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. No more writing monthly checks or making monthly PayPal contributions. issuesetc.org. Click donate and fill out and mail the automatic withdrawal form. Thanks for your support.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We at NewReformationPress.com are committed to providing a hand-picked selection of books and teaching materials that educate, inform, and entertain while relentlessly focusing on the gospel. Discover our growing library of resources by Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn radio program, including his powerful address, The Gospel for Those Broken by the Church, or Bible in an Hour by Pastor Wade Butler. And be sure not to miss our selection of t-shirts, gifts, and artwork. NewReformationPress.com. Finally, Reformation theology made accessible.
Here's a new way to stay connected to Issues Etc. Check out our page on Facebook. Network with fellow Issues Etc. junkies. Sign up to become a fan, and we'll send you updates on future topics and guests. You'll even find photos of in-studio guests, Todd drinking chelada, and highlights from our one-year anniversary open house. You'll discover that Todd, Jeff, and Craig really do have faces for radio on Facebook. Issues Etc. on Facebook. Another way to stay connected to Issues Etc. www.facebook.com.
I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes in this hour on this Thursday afternoon, 23rd of July. Terry Mattingly is our guest. You can read Terry's On Religion columns under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Terry, what's the McChurch?
Well, I mean, there have been arguments about what's going on in megachurches and superchurches. Those arguments about those things go all the way back in the 70s and 80s, too. I think what's really happening with McChurch is an expression of two things. One is the role that entertainment is actually beginning to play in a lot of worship services. Specifically, I mean, you see these amazing statistics that 85% of the churches in America that are growing have introduced large-screen plasma technology into the front of their sanctuaries, you know, for the use of multimedia. I can say that in the early 90s, when I taught at Denver Theological Seminary, a lot of people thought that my goal was to try to teach people how to do this kind of media and worship, and my goal was actually exactly the opposite. I was trying to get people to pay attention to the content of entertainment culture so that the church could respond through the strengths the church has in traditional ministry. I didn't want people, you know, slapping stuff up and start showing clips out of The Daily Show in the middle of worship services, which you could already see that sort of thing coming in the early 90s. So to some degree, we're talking about what theological entertainment, you know, and whether that is whether that's an issue today. So that's part of it. The other thing, and my column is based on a book that came out from two men at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and it's very telling that these are not liberals attacking evangelical superchurches. These are two professors at the largest Southern Baptist seminary in the world, okay? These are the people who build big churches, okay? So they're, in effect, criticizing within their own tent, which I think is really crucial. The other thing that the McChurch, with the implications of franchising, you know, the golden arches of McChurch or something like that, I think the other implication here is as we move into the post-denominational age where, you know, it's all about the individual pastor, it's all about that charismatic figure, it's all about who's got the best show on Sunday morning, now we're actually beginning to develop, instead of McChurches, what these two men call McDenominations, to where, in effect, you franchise your church out. And all of a sudden now you've got six churches or six campuses in an individual town, and, you know, at the magic moment during the service, the big screen clicks on, and there's the same super preacher, you know, in all of his glory preaching at you all over town. And then now we're hearing talk about churches franchising globally, you know, but with the same pastor, and I would definitely put that inside scare quotes with my fingers up doing quote marks, your pastor, you know, might be six zip codes away. You know, I mean, we're changing the very definition of a lot of the church, with this trend.
What's the difference between kind of doing those satellite franchise churches for a mega church in a big metropolitan area? Little Creek does this. I don't know how many satellites they have, a whole number of them, where at least the teaching portion, the preaching, I would hope that it might be preaching rather than just simply infotainment, is piped in high def. And I got to wonder, what's the difference between that and me sitting at home watching Joel Osteen? I can get him in high def, too.
Well, I mean, they're saying that there is an actual community that you're sitting with, and that community can do Bible studies. That community can have a soup kitchen. That there is a community there, but it is a community that is franchised to this other church. And here's where I think is really interesting. In effect, now we have entire networks that are riding the talent and skill set and theological vision of one man. Now you say, what's the difference between that and Lutheranism? Well, I mean, to some degree, maybe once upon a time, or Wesley riding around on his horseback. There's nothing in the annals of church history that compares to this in terms of the amount of financial clout, doctrinal clout, cultural clout, even political clout, being placed in the hands of one man.
It is a very American way of quote-unquote doing church.
Oh, mercy is American. Yeah.
So does it have a – I'm trying to – we always say about the megachurches, can you do it in the inner city? Could you do it in Rwanda? You know, those kind of things. Is this, is this, as some would suppose or assert, the real shape of things to come for the church, the rest of us just getting left behind?
Well, I think you'd have to say that the post-denominational age is here to stay in Protestantism, that you're going to have some people fleeing that to join churches with very strong senses of church history. I mean, you have the trend of Protestants leaving to become Roman Catholics and Orthodox, and in previous decades, Anglicans, and maybe still to alternative, more conservative Anglican churches. You still have that going on, but at the same time, you have more and more people choosing this kind of, there's nothing you can call it except consumer-oriented approach to church. This church gives me the following services. This church has the following pastor who I find insightful, funny, entertaining, witty, etc. And thus, I will go purchase these services.
Finally, Terry, can you explain, you've written about this recently, but can you explain the ecumenical steps between between the Orthodox Church in America and the newly formed Anglican Church in North America?
Well, it's a very interesting story. I don't know how many people it affects because these are both small bodies. I think the most important thing from a news perspective about this is that this remarkable young bishop, and when I say bishop, I mean this is a man who's 49 years old and is already the leader of the Orthodox Church in America, which is the Russian Heritage Church in America. And Metropolitan Jonah, you know, just this time last year was not even a bishop. He was the head of a monastery and was forming missions in Northern California. He is a convert from the Episcopal Church, which means his roots are into this kind of Anglo-Catholic vision of conservative Anglicans. But he is also the successor to a remarkable saint in the history of Orthodoxy in America, Saint Tikhon of Moscow, who came to America as a missionary and basically brought Orthodoxy in a structural sense to the United States and to North America. You know, traveled all over Mexico, North America, Canada, etc. Then St. Tikhon was called home to Moscow, where he was elected patriarch, and died under very suspicious circumstances in the midst of his struggles against the Bolsheviks. So here you have a man who's both saint and martyr, and in the United States you have him playing this historic role. Well, in a very real sense, Metropolitan Jonah is the successor to St. Tikhon, you know, many times removed. But still, that's who he is. St. Tikhon had reached out to conservative Anglicans and challenged them to return to communion with the Eastern Church. And there was a brief period of time, early in the 20th century, where it looked like that was a distinct possibility. Well, what Jonah did was he stood up in front of this beleaguered, you know, besieged group of conservative Anglicans and said to them, "Why would I even want to talk to the Episcopal Church today? I'm willing to talk to you." So that was a very important ecumenical event, you know, in part because of what it signaled about the relationships between Orthodoxy and the Anglican Communion, or the Episcopal Church to be specific, as, you know, as what practical steps, you know, he could take.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, author of the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder of GetReligion.org. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thanks. Talk to you again.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss creation with Pastor Alfonso Espinosa. Folks, it's still not too late for you to attend the National Lutherans for Life Conference beginning tomorrow afternoon at the Doubletree Westport in St. Louis. We're going to be broadcasting live tomorrow afternoon from the lobby of the Doubletree, right outside where the conference is meeting, from 3 to 5 at the Doubletree Westport in St. Louis for the National Conference of Lutherans for Life. One of our guests, among the many, 3 to 5 tomorrow, will be the brother of Terry Schindler Schiavo. That's the National Conference for Lutherans for Life. We'll be broadcasting live there. You'll see our live broadcast and get to meet many of the great guests and those who are in attendance in the Lutherans for Life conference. For more information, visit lutheransforlife.org, lutheransforlife.org. It's nice to hear that the matters of religion, even if the news is bad, even if the news is sobering and sad, such as the tremendous and now perhaps even irreparable compromises of once quite noble Christian denominations in the United States, the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church USA, the path to compromise is, well, it always leads in the same direction. And although they come from two very different places, both of those great compromised churches obviously and hopefully won't, but probably will end up in exactly the same place. That's where compromise takes you. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.